Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, veteran journalist Tedrick Smith, has covered the civil rights protests in the Deep South, reported on the Vietnam War in Saigon, the Cold War in Moscow, and covered six U.S. presidents. He's been making documentaries for Frontline and PBS for more than 25 years. Today, he is telling a positive story that many in the media are missing. It's the story of grassroots heroes and citizen movements working to reform the system. Tedrick Smith calls it the Democracy Rebellion. These are everyday people taking on big money and lobbyists to fight against corruption, gerrymandering, dark money, and for voting rights. In a new documentary for PBS called The Democracy Rebellion, Tedrick Smith takes us to six states where citizen activist leaders are fighting to reform the system: Washington State, South Dakota, North Carolina, Florida, Connecticut, and California. In Connecticut, the public funding of campaigns has transformed state politics and who can actually afford to run. In Florida, gerrymandering reform was voted in by a supermajority and caught lawmakers who were secretly violating that law. And in California, the crackdown on dark money funding has provided a model for other states. Smith says that 2018 was the best year for political reform since the 1960s, and these reforms are having real impact today. Tedrick Smith is an Emmy Award-winning producer and correspondent. He spent 26 years at the New York Times as a reporter, editor, and bureau chief in Moscow and Washington. He was a member of the Pulitzer Prize-winning team for the Pentagon Papers series, and in 1974, he won the Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting from Russia and Eastern Europe. In 1990, he founded Tedrick Smith Productions. He's created more than 20 primetime PBS miniseries and broadcast specials. He's the author of many books, including Who Stole the American Dream? And his latest documentary, The Democracy Rebellion, can be seen in more than 100 cities this month. You can watch it on your local PBS station or online. And Tedrick Smith joins us from Washington, D.C. Hi, Tedrick. Thanks so much for joining us.
Rose, I want to tell you, my mother was listening and she thought that was wonderful. Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be with you.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciated your documentary because it is such an important story to tell about these activists who are working to create systemic change. And Tedrick, on a show like this, where we still have the luxury of having an hour to talk about issues, we go into the issues you discuss. But why do you think this story is missing from so much of the media?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons. Number one, the political media in America is concentrated in Washington, and they don't get out of the city. And they think that the only news that's happening they know about, if they do get out in the country, it's to go cover Democratic candidates running for president or the president himself going to rallies in Florida or in Wisconsin or in Pennsylvania, or perhaps with a member of Congress who's going home to have a meeting, with constituents. And it's sort of like going out on a light beam. Or on a straw. They go out in the straw and they see one little blip and then they come back and say, well, I was out in the country. I think there's a really limited attitude, a limited imagination, a limited perspective from the basic political coverage we're getting. And then on top of that, I think cable news has got a whole lot of people talking on panels hour after hour after hour after hour ad nauseum, adding absolutely nothing to our knowledge. They do add opinion. And they do add debate, but they don't add any reporting or very, very little of it. So what I did, and not because I did it, but anybody who does it, whether they do it in America or they do it in Syria or they do it in Iran or they do it in Latin America, anybody who goes out and does reporting takes time, takes cost, mm-hmm. takes effort, involves failure. You go for stories, you look for them, you don't find them. There's not immediate gratification, and an awful lot of the, particularly the younger people in the media in Washington, want to be on the air instantly, want to occupy time, want to have their face on the air, want to have their bylines in the paper. I have to say, as a longtime journalist, I don't have high respect for that as quality journalism. There are really good reporters among the Washington press corps. but they're a small minority, and most of them tend to be veterans, I mean, who've been for a while. I don't mean older, but just people who've been doing it for a while and who understand the amount of work it takes to get really good stories. And news organizations have been cut back drastically in their staff because of economics, so they don't have the staff to go do these stories. And the other thing is Trump and Trump News, whether it's pro-Trump or anti-Trump, is enormously profitable, right, particularly for electronic media, but also for the print media. Covering Trump to a fairly well, covering his critics, covering the Khashoggi assassination, covering Jared Kushner, all aspects of the Trump story have attracted readers and viewers. So it's really profitable to do that. So you get two things working here. One is the kind of a insular beltway mindset of the Washington Press Corps, and the other is the economics of the business continues to drive people to where it's easy to get audience. It's what I call fire engine journalism. If you're a local, well, you all know this, if you're a local TV station, what you do is you get a police radio and you listen to when the fire alarm goes, and you send your camera crew out after the fire trucks, and you get great pictures of flames, which are dramatic. And maybe there's a serious problem there, and you cover that, and it looks like you've covered the news. Well, maybe the real problem is there a good business code? Was this building built by a slum landlord that should have been more careful and ignored fire regulations? I mean, the in-depth story takes time and money to investigate. And it's easier to just jump from one fire to the next and not do the serious work.
Right. And the scandals really do sell.
There's no question. There's no question. And we've got, and whereas a public, we've also, well, if you watch Hollywood movies and if you watch television, we've become accustomed to very quick cuts, to very short bites, to very superficial information. We've been fed a lot of popcorn and potato chips and peanuts as news. And we no longer even hunger for a good steak or a good salmon, grilled salmon or something like that. You know, something really meaty in the news as an audience. And so the news media have kind of cultured the audience they want, and the audience has now become what they want. And so the news media say, and I've had this discussion with people in Washington, well, we're just delivering people what they want. We're delivering them the biggest story there is. Well, the impeachment of a president is the biggest story around. There's no disputing that. But it's not the only story around. And that's my contention.
So why did you decide to travel to six states to find these stories of everyday citizens really trying to reform the system?
Well, I actually didn't. I didn't decide to do that. The two things happened. Number one, I wrote a book, which you kindly mentioned, Who Stole the American Dream, which was my attempt 7 years ago to explain to myself as well as other people how we got in the terrible economic mess we're in with the gross inequalities of income and wealth in this country, and the middle class not being well served by politics of either party, and the dysfunctional political system we had. And I was going around the country giving talks on university campuses and to civic groups and Commonwealth Club of San Francisco and other groups like that, Seattle Town Hall, whatnot. And people were asking me, what do we do about it? Is there anybody doing anything about it? Well, I had a little bit about political reform and economic reform in my book, but not much. So I decided I better do some reporting. So while I was traveling the country doing the speeches, I was using those trips as a way to start to ask what was happening. And then as I gathered material, I put it on a website. I created a website so I could say, go look at the website if you want to find out what's happening. It's called ReclaimTheAmericanDream.org. The book was Who Stole It? And the website is ReclaimTheAmericanDream.org. And I really began gathering material. I didn't find the six states right away. I didn't go looking for this story. I went looking for what's happening in America, much like a foreign correspondent in my own country. As a foreign correspondent in Saigon, in Cairo, in Moscow, in Paris, I covered not those countries, but probably 30 or 40 countries. And I learned very early on, you can't cover a country by sitting in the capital. So I also had the habit of going out and trying to find the stories that people in the capital weren't telling you. And maybe they weren't telling you because they didn't know, and maybe they weren't telling you because it was embarrassing to them, but they weren't talking about it. So I guess I had two things happening. Number one, what I was doing just took me to the country. And number two, my habit as a reporter was to take advantage of that kind of a situation and do the reporting. And only over time did I come not to six states, but I could have done 10 or 12 states. And I did. And like any good reporter, I drilled dry holes. I mean, I went looking at states and I heard things that was going on. And they turned out to be okay, but not terribly interesting, or the movement really didn't develop. So, you know, it's trial and error. It's not knowing what the story is before you start. It's letting the story emerge and discovering it.
Right. It was great to meet all of these people in these six states and just to watch to see what is most effective. What really struck you when you met these activists who are doing everything from gathering signatures to raising awareness and even suing politicians at the state Supreme Court level?
Well, as a guy who's covered a lot of countries and, you know, covered uprisings in the Middle East and in Lebanon and in Egypt, popular protests, and in Russia, dissidents, and all across Eastern Europe and in Saigon, the war and that kind of stuff, I was utterly amazed, given the disenchantment, the pessimism, the despair, the anger, the frustration of Americans about the state of politics in America. I was utterly amazed at seeing ordinary people who were so moved and who decided to use their anger constructively to take action in states that I never would expect. I mean, South Dakota, North Carolina, Florida, it's probably unfair to them, but those are not states like California and Massachusetts and New York that are known for reform. And by the way, some of those states are well ahead of New York and Massachusetts, which need to do a lot of reform that they haven't tackled. California's got a pretty strong record. But I was just blown away because I've seen a lot of stuff. And I'd sat in Washington for a while when I came back here from overseas. I ran the Washington Bureau of the New York Times. I did a lot of reporting out of here. But the television reporting I did for PBS took me out in the country. Even so, to run into people like Cindy Black in Seattle, or Linda Bach, one of her friends in Seattle, both of them women, you know, in their 60s, grandmothers, who were so upset by the Citizens United decision of the Supreme Court to unleash the floodgates of corporate and billionaire money into political campaigns that they got into organizing a petition to put on the ballot a vote in the state of Washington to roll back Citizens United. Linda Bach collected 21,000 signatures personally. I mean, she said when I talked to her, I said, why'd you do this? What's going on? She said, I feel like I'm in the tradition of the American Revolution. Every signature I get is a check for the Constitution. Democracy, you have to fight for it or it'll slip right out of your hands. Mm-hmm. Now, there's just an extraordinary piece of understanding of the political realities in America today in those simple statements. And then to go collect 21,000 signatures is just one hell of a down payment on those words. I mean, there are a lot of people in this country, and I run into them all the time at cocktail parties, at dinner parties, traveling, and so forth, who complain terribly about what the situation is with our political system, with our campaigns, with voter suppression, with dark money, all those kinds of things. But they don't do anything about it. There's a woman named Ellen Friedan whom I met, very, very impressive lawyer, very savvy political lawyer, but not a mass organizer, who turned into a mass organizer. And she said to me when I said, is there any message to what you did in Florida? She said, the message is, if you're upset about American politics, get out there and fix them. It can be done. Mm-hmm. And then her Hispanic counterpart, Jorge Mercilli, said, if we can do it in Florida, you can do it in your state. I mean, they're just a central truce there from these people. And they're not ordinary people. They're ordinary in the sense that we don't know them. They're extraordinary in their sense of understanding, commitment, dedication, and willingness to work. Ellen Friedan told me she worked on the campaign to fix gerrymandering in Florida 80 hours a week for probably 3 or 4 years, unpaid.
Well,
I mean, that's just, it knocks you out to meet people like that.
Today we're speaking with Hedrick Smith, an Emmy award-winning producer and correspondent who's been making documentaries for Frontline and PBS for more than 25 years. And I hope you can take the time to watch his new documentary called The Democracy Rebellion. It's airing in 100 cities across the country, so you can watch it on your local PBS station or online. And if you have any questions for Hedrick about what he found in these six states, Washington, South Dakota, North Carolina, Florida, Connecticut, in California, we'd love to hear from you. As he said, amazing people are working on issues like gerrymandering, dark money, voter suppression, and they are succeeding. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Or you can tweet at Your Call Radio. Hedrick, since you brought up your first stop, which was Seattle, you mentioned that these amazing group of volunteers were galvanizing support to curb billionaire and corporate money campaigns. And you note in your documentary that because of the Citizens United decision in 2010, which overturned a centuries-old ban on corporate spending, I mean, these numbers are really amazing. Unregulated campaign spending by independent political groups shot up from $8 million in the year 2009 to $301 million in 2010 to $1.4 billion in 2016. And we're going to definitely break records again in 2020.
Yeah. Well, and the reason for focusing on unregulated independent expenditures is that's where the added money goes. There are still regulations on how much individuals can give to parties and to individual candidates. But there are no regulations at all on how much can be done in terms of donations to independent political groups, political action committees, PACs. And many of them have these anodyne names that tell you nothing. Americans for Responsible Leadership, the Center to Protect Patient Rights, Americans for Job Security. It's motherhood and nationhood, and it all sounds good, but you have no idea whose money is behind it. And these are vehicles for hiding, channels for hiding the donations of either corporations, corporate executives, or very wealthy individuals who don't want to be known. And if you want to, we can get into the California story. But before we do, you kindly mentioned that the program is playing. It's actually playing on almost 200 stations. Yeah. It's moved forward since we sent you the information. But it's playing tonight. It's playing tonight on KQED in San Francisco,
great,
tonight on KPBS in San Diego, tonight on KVPT in Fresno, and tonight on KOCE in Los Angeles. So we just happen to be talking at a good moment. The schedule, we have the schedule. We can make it available. It is on YouTube at the channel named The Democracy Rebellion. You can see it 24/7 there. Or you can see it on a PBS website at pbs.org if you look for The Democracy Rebellion. But the main thing is it's happening in California on PBS tonight. So I hope people will tune in.
That's great. And you can find information also at yourcallradio.org. So the good news out of Washington is that 63% of the voters there rejected Citizens United and unlimited money in campaigns. Your documentary points out that it takes 34 states to force Congress to act on a constitutional amendment, and so far 20 states are on record against Citizens United.
Well, there are two ways to amend the Constitution, and most people, we've only used one of them, and that 34 states involves Plan B. Plan A, the typical way we've amended the Constitution in the past, is for both houses of Congress to pass an amendment, the language of an amendment, with a two-thirds majority vote, and then send it to the states, and then three-quarters of the states have to ratify it. At the present, that would be 38. There is an alternative method, which is to call a constitutional convention, like the one that drafted the Constitution in Philadelphia. And to do that, you need two-thirds of the states to call for a constitutional convention to be called. So that's what the 20 states have done. There are some legal questions as to whether or not they will all count, whether or not each one of them has kind of done it the right way. But the thought of the strategist is that if we get to 34, that itself will be enough pressure on Congress so that Congress will start to act and pass a constitutional amendment the right way. But the important thing is that 20 states, one way or another, you did it in California with a popular vote. They did it in Washington State with a popular vote. Same thing in Colorado, same thing in Montana. You know, back east where you don't have the referendum procedure, it's action of the state legislature or a letter from the governor to and the state legislative leaders to the Congress calling on them to act. That's what Massachusetts, Connecticut, New York, and states like that did. So it's in process. I think the last state to take action was Nevada after Washington State passed. Then Nevada did, and that's how we got to 20. But the point is there's a good deal of momentum behind this, and there's obviously a lot of public anger that's boiled up into political action.
Right. So let's talk about what happened in California since we were discussing dark money. I mean, this just makes your head spin. I mean, even living in California, I remembered when that happened, but watching your documentary, I learned so many new details about these groups that just funnel money to each other. So for just a little bit of background, Jerry Brown was pushing for a ballot proposal back in 2012 when he was governor. It was a tax increase to fund public education, and it was Prop 30, and the No on 30 ads were sponsored by the California Small Business Action Committee, but voters were left in the dark about who actually paid for them. So you point out that a group called Americans for Responsible Leadership gave $11 million to the Small Business Action Committee, but they got the $11 million from a group called the Center to Protect Patient Rights. The money was then tracked to Americans for Job Security. I have to say, I was really impressed with how you told this head-spinning story in such a nice way. I mean, you've been doing this for so long, so you really know your stuff. But
well, I can tell you the story is much, much more complicated than we did. What we did is we tried to pick a thread, a flow of money that you could follow. There were actually multiple flows of money, and we focused on one particular $11 million flow of money. There was actually almost $30 million involved. Mm-hmm. But what was fascinating, and I think the story in California, which began and was broken initially in 2012, which is quite a while ago, was the first time that both political watchdog groups like the California Fair Political Practices Commission and the political press in Washington and around the country had a chance to see how these dark money networks actually operated. I think a lot of people sort of guessed how they worked, but it was like the elephant in the dark room. You could feel the trunk, you could feel the arm, but you couldn't really see the elephant. And suddenly the elephant came into view. And what was very clear, and what was very interesting, was we'll get to these in a moment. There were a bunch of very wealthy Californians who wanted to do two things. They wanted to oppose a $50 billion tax increase to fund public education. And when you hear these people and their names, they're not supposed to be against funding public education in terms of their public position, okay? So that's why they went covert. And secondly, several of them were friends of Governor Brown, and so they didn't really want to be seen opposing the governor on one of his issues. And they also backed another issue, which was to ban political contributions from labor unions, that is, using membership dues to pay political contributions. And they didn't, you know, really want to be seen for doing that. So what they did is they found a way to take money from California, $29 million, ship it to a Koch unit called Americans for Job Security in Virginia. It then shipped the money, part of the money, to the Center to Protect Patient Rights, which then shipped the money to Americans for Responsible Leadership in Arizona, which then shipped the money to the Small Business Action Committee in California, which then spent the millions of dollars on very late ads in the referendum and ballot initiative campaign. And somebody spotted $11 million suddenly, bing, coming from this group in Arizona, which had never been involved in California campaigns before, and said, whoops, that looks unusual. And they went back and they looked and they found that group had never spent more than $50,000 on any political campaign. So where did it get $11 million from? How did it get that money? And that's when the ball starts to unravel. And the California, it gets reported by Common Cause to the California Fair Political Practices Commission. And then for me as a journalist, it just becomes a dream, because a good investigative story, which has an important political impact, is about as good as it gets. So you start to follow the money, and you start to go back, and they find this guy, Gary Winnick and Ann Ravel, who were at the Fair Political Practices Commission at the time, do their investigation. They wind up by getting a call from a high-powered Washington attorney, he was represented all kinds of big Republican interests, including the Koch brothers, and including presidential campaigns and so forth. And they say, whoa, we've stumbled into a hornet's nest here. And they begin to track it down, track the money back. And what I just described to you is the flow, the money chart, the flow of the money, you know, from California to Virginia and back around through Arizona, back to California. It takes a year after the election for Gary Winnick, the investigative chief at the FPPC, to put the piece together. He finds a couple of big Republican operatives involved in one thing or another. And then he gets hold of the list of the donors. Now, at that time, under California law, people could claim, if they didn't know the law, they didn't know the rules exactly, they had a one bite of the apple. They could claim a freebie. They could say, I didn't know, so I did it wrong once, and they couldn't be prosecuted. And that loophole has since been closed. But at that time, so the names weren't initially revealed, but when it got a hold of a paper with all the names on it, with all the donors on it, but the names blocked out. And somebody from the Los Angeles Times held the paper up to light. And by looking up through the light, they doped out the names. And what you got was the Fisher family, you know, of Gap fame, and Charles Schwab, you know, the big investor in the investment house, you know, and Eli Broad, who is a Los Angeles donor to educational causes and a major spokesman for public education and educational reform. And there were lots of other donors, but those were the three main ones. So it's a great story about citizen activists, because it was Common Cause that triggered the investigation, a good watchdog system in California, and good laws which then got amended so that California doesn't stop with the name that doesn't tell you anything. Americans for Responsible Leadership. It requires them to reveal their donors, and they can track back until they finally get to other to the actual individuals who put up the money. Now, a lot of states have disclosure laws, but they're not as tough, they're not as careful, and the watchdogs, the enforcers, are not as good as Ann Ravel and Gary Winnick were. It's a great story. I mean, it's a, not just a great story, but it is a model. It's an example for other states, and importantly for the federal system. The Federal Election Commission is nowhere near as effective as this. Mm-hmm. Ann Ravel went from California, as you probably know, and became both a member and then chair of the Federal Election Commission, and was so frustrated by the partisan gridlock there, she quit.
Yep.
Came home, and she's now, I guess, running for the state Senate. But it's a disaster that we don't have something as good as what California has at the federal level.
The law in California also closed those loopholes, right?
Yes, they did. They
right.
passed in 2014, there were new laws passed. Ravel and went back with friendly legislators, and they closed those loopholes. So now when the money comes in, you can actually see the top 10 donors to any group by name on the Secretary of State's website, if you know how to navigate the website.
Huh. We're going to take a quick break. We're speaking with Hedrick Smith, an Emmy Award-winning producer and correspondent who's been making documentaries for Frontline and PBS for more than 25 years. He's a longtime reporter out with a really important new documentary called The Democracy Rebellion. We were just talking about this Koch brother-sponsored effort to quash a ballot proposal in 2012 that would have increased taxes to fund public education. And this documentary is airing on many PBS affiliates tonight. If you're in the Bay Area, it'll be on KQED. You can check times at yourcallradio.org. You can also find the documentary online. Be sure to share it with friends and colleagues. You can also check out the website reclaimtheamericandream.org. We're going to take a quick break. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's toll free, 866-798-8255. You can also post a comment or question on the website at yourcallradio.org. You may tweet us at Your Call Radio. Calling the shots in the year of the nurse and the midwife. That's the topic for 1A at 11 o'clock this morning, just a half an hour from now, right after Your Call, here on 91.7 KALW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will continue our coverage of electronic voting machines. We'll find out how many people across the country will be voting on these machines in November, and we'll find out about security and potential hacks. In fact, the CEOs of three of the biggest voting equipment manufacturers are going to be testifying on Capitol Hill. Oh, it looks like they did it last week, so we'll find out what they said, election systems and software were scheduled to appear. So we'll talk about voting machines tomorrow. And then on Thursday, we'll open the lines to find out what you would like from the show this year, given that it's an election year. What do you want from Your Call? So I hope you can join us from that. You can email show ideas to yourcall@kalw.org. Today we're joined by longtime journalist Hedrick Smith. He's an Emmy Award-winning producer and correspondent. He spent 26 years with the New York Times. He's been making documentaries for Frontline and PBS for more than 25 years. And he's out with a very important new documentary called The Democracy Rebellion. It's about everyday people taking on the big money like the Koch brothers and lobbyists to fight against corruption, gerrymandering, dark money, and for voting rights. And if you'd like to join us, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Hedrick, we have a question from Bill in Berkeley who says, assuming enough states call for a new constitutional convention, what is to keep it from being co-opted by the rich and powerful to rewrite the Constitution to enact the right-wing agenda?
There's nothing to stop that. We've never had a constitutional convention except the original one. We have no idea how the rules would be written, but the legal experts that I talk to say they expect that a constitutional convention, once called, could write its own rules, that there's no reason to believe that if it's called by 34 states or more to amend the Constitution to roll back Citizens United, there's no reason to believe that it can be limited to that, and you can't get the conservatives who want to pass a balanced budget amendment or voting rights restrictions or all kinds of other proposals from doing that. So a lot of it depends not just on getting the convention, but being extremely well organized to make sure that the delegations are picked in a way that reflects the popular referendum in your state to roll back Citizens United, and that's something else. So the people who organize it and push that to the limit have to be ready when they get to 29, 30, 31, 32 states to take a look at who's controlling the state government, the state legislature, who would be appointing the delegates to the convention. It's a very tricky operation. I mean, there are some people whom I know, particularly at Common Cause, which is a strong it's a group that strongly advocates repealing the Citizens United decision, who feel that it's a mistake to push for a constitutional convention, that it could be a runaway convention and could be very dangerous. There are other people like the Wolfpack, which is another group that wants to overturn Citizens United, who say it's the only way to go. Mm. We'll never get Congress to pass a two-thirds vote as long as you have Republican Party leaders, not necessarily rank and file, but leaders in Congress committed to opposing an amendment. So there's a dispute even among the advocates of reform.
Well, thank you for the email, Bill. We have an email from Jackie, a retired educator in Oakland, and she says, I cannot wait to see the documentary. In Oakland and across the country, we are facing huge amounts of dark money pouring into local school board races, including from Eli Broad, Michael Bloomberg, and others. They're not supporters of public education. Their aim is to privatize public schools and undermine democratic governance of schools through promoting charters and, in other states, vouchers.
Well, I think what this listener has put her finger on is that political reform is the gateway to other issues. In other words, if you've got a political system that is stacked or rigged by partisan gerrymandering to favor, and at the moment it tends to favor more Republicans than Democrats, though both parties do it, but it's just the Republicans politically control more states than the Democrats do. But if you've got rigged elections, if you've got the power of big money, which comes in not just during elections, but you have to understand that maybe the most important donation that a candidate for Congress receives comes the morning after he or she wins the seat, mm-hmm. because most of them who run for the first time are deeply in debt. And imagine how you feel towards the donor who comes in with a big chunk of money the morning after you've won and says, nice going, here's money, remember me when we get down the road to, you know, oil depletion allowances or bank fees or taxes or whatever the issue is. So there's no question that if we don't do something about limiting money, about particularly exposing money, and in some states using public funding to counteract big money, and we haven't talked about that, Rose, but we should. It's tremendous. It's a really effective program. Then we're going to be stuck with a Congress that is constantly, if not beholden to, at least looking over its shoulder at and handing its hand out to people who've got big money. And certainly partisan gerrymandering has an impact. So if you want to deal with public education and you want to deal with immigration and you want to deal with health care, and you want to deal with minimum wage and work laws, no matter what your issue is across the board, if the political system is tilted in favor in one direction or another, it's very difficult to get fair treatment of those issues. And it's very difficult for the average person and the citizen majority to be heard effectively. Mm. There are already very good studies that have been done, one by political scientists named Marty Gillens at Princeton University, who studied 2,000 votes in the U.S. Senate over a period of a decade. And what he found was that the votes of the senators very closely matched the opinions of the top 1 or 2% and occasionally matched the opinions of the majority, but only if that happened to be the same as the opinions of the and the priorities of the top 1 or 2%. In other words, the public suspicion that money talks and money has influence in the halls of Congress and actually swings the votes was supported by his detailed analysis of 2,000 votes in the U.S. Senate, which is pretty striking.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that email, Jackie. Let's go to a caller, Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. I hope you can hear me. Unfortunately, I have to talk on my speakerphone.
No, you're fine. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. I'd like to ask your guest, Mr. Smith, a question about the environment. And maybe I could just preface it with a little bit of a story here. I live in Palo Alto, a very affluent community in the mid-peninsula. And people here like to think they're somewhat enlightened or conscious about the environment. I question that seriously. I recently went to a climate strike event in downtown Palo Alto, which was attended by less than 100 people in early December. A lot of them were young people. And it seems to me that, you know, I can't believe that the people in my city government don't realize that climate change and global warming is a real issue, but they continue to be hell-bent on growth and development, which is contributing to climate change and global warming. And they just seem to be either ignorant or they don't care. And I think basically what's at the bottom here, you brought this up, it's money. I mean, they want to build more business here. They want more development because they think this is going to create more jobs and more income for the city government to be able to provide services. I don't know how you get around that, because it seems to me that if they don't feel a sense of urgency about climate change, I don't know what's going to get them to feel that. So I don't know what you've run into in your journeys about this kind of issue and whether or not there's people who are really making headway someplace as a result of your investigations.
Yeah. Well, let me just say to your caller that I didn't focus on specific issues such as environment or health care. I was really focusing on how the political system works and whether or not it's distorted. Probably the most effective state in your area in terms of counteracting climate is Washington State, north of you. If you recall, the governor tried to run for president of the United States on a green platform that is dealing with climate change. So it is a problem. But, you know, I think what you're talking about also goes to the basic issue I'm talking about, and that is whether or not people feel they can get engaged in politics, whether or not at the city, county, state, or federal level, and particularly works at the local level. There is a sense that government's gotten away from us, that government doesn't listen to us, that lobbyists have captured it, that corporations and wealthy investors who want profits can put their interests and get their interests heard better than ordinary people who say, yeah, I want jobs, I want growth, but not at too much of a cost. So I think the issue here is not just can we do something about climate change or gun safety or whatever it is, but can citizens effectively make themselves heard, felt, and represented by their local governments? I mean, that's the issue. If you don't have a majority with you, then no matter how passionately you feel, you're probably not going to get there. But the terrible thing is if you do have a majority with you, but it's not active, then there's an injustice, political injustice, on top of the issue injustice. So I think a lot of it is engagement. And the question I would have for you is, how are you organized? Who have you rallied? Who do you bond with? What kind of efforts are they making? How do you bring the issue in front of the city council or the county commissioners? I don't know exactly what the local government setup is, you know, and your county as well as your city. So, I mean, it's getting beyond. I think the whole point of the democracy rebellion is, how do people get beyond frustration, get beyond anger, get beyond voicing their opinion into a movement, into an organization, into an effort and a drive that will actually affect the policy outcome or the fairness of the political system in the region where they live. And what's impressed me is more and more people are awakening to the fact that they can't count on Washington. They can't count on their state legislature if they want to get something done. They've got to do it themselves. And I'm impressed with the fact that so many people are doing that. I mean, to think of it, 2018 was the best year, the most active year for political reform in this country in half a century since the Civil Rights Movement. Five states adopted gerrymander reform: Ohio, Michigan, Missouri, Colorado, and Utah. Three other states adopted election law reform: Maine, Florida, and North Dakota. Think how different those states are. Seven other states made it easier to register to vote or to vote. Four cities, Baltimore, Phoenix, Denver, and Portland, Oregon, adopted public funding of campaigns. I mean, this suggests the spread of citizen action. This suggests that the ferment and the frustration that your caller, that you just expressed, is being turned by smart, dedicated people into action that wins results. Mm. I'm impressed with that as a reporter.
Mm. Well, thank you for calling in, Greg. Let's go next to Paul in Larkspur. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. I just wanted to share experience I had. I lived in Asheville, North Carolina from 2009 to 2014. The neighborhood I lived in was gerrymandered out of North Carolina 11 to North Carolina 10. And the point I really want to make is the importance of local media and how it doesn't exist the way it does here in the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. In 2010, a rich conservative gentleman named Art Pope basically bought the New York, North Carolina General Assembly. And then when the census results came out, the Republicans gained control of the legislature in California for the first time in over a century. The Democratic Party was basically asleep at the wheel. I did not even know this happened, and I consider myself a well-informed person, until I read an article in the New Yorker magazine in 2011. The local media in Asheville did not cover this story. They were too busy covering stories of restaurant reviews and high school football and reprints from USA Today. So I congratulate KLW for providing, being an important provider of local coverage. And I think I have serious concerns about many parts of this country where there is no local media.
Well, I have to say, I share your frustration. I know the Asheville story. I've covered it myself. I want to just give you a sequel to it. What happened was the Moral Monday movement filed and others filed a suit in federal court to challenge the gerrymandering. And you're absolutely right. Asheville was a Democratic area. It was deliberately split in half, put into two different congressional districts, both turned out to be overwhelmingly conservative. And the leader who was elected down there is Mark Meadows, is one of the most outspoken conservative representatives in Congress. But that has now been challenged in state court. And a state court has overturned what the legislature did, and Mark Meadows has announced he's not running for re-election. And the reason is his district has suddenly become competitive again. So while you had to live through it and the local press didn't report it, somebody in North Carolina got organized, did something about it, brought it to a state court. The state court ruled it was unconstitutional under the North Carolina Constitution, not the federal, but the state constitution. And the next election looks in North Carolina as though it will be quite different from the last five elections. But we'll have to see. But the point is, people like you felt upset about the very situation you were talking about and found out about it through not the local press, but something called North Carolina Watch or Common Cause North Carolina or activist groups in the state. And they've done something about it, and the situation is changing. Mm-hmm. So that can be done, and it is being done. That's my point in my story.
Well, thank you for calling, Paul. Hedrick, we're almost out of time. I want to talk about two more states because these stories are really amazing. In your documentary, we learn about what happened in Connecticut in 2008. Connecticut implemented public financing for state elections, one of four states using this kind of reform. And as a result, you had a number of African Americans from low-income communities running for office and winning. This resulted in more women, blacks, and Latinos in office. And as you said, this is what you need to pass and change, pass legislation, good legislation. So as a result, in Connecticut, people there got schools to get junk food out. There were reforms, first state to pass paid sick leave. You had gun control because groups like the NRA were not able to influence politicians because they don't fund them. So just give us a thumbnail sketch of what you found in Connecticut and what really stood out for you.
Well, I would say the reform in Connecticut was one of the most surprising and impressive that I ran into all over the country. People forget that we had public funding of campaigns in presidential campaigns from 1976 to 1996. And what happened was, and it was done through a very simple, funded through a very simple method. People could check a box on their income tax return and donate $3 of their taxes. They weren't paying any more. They're just donating or earmarking $3 of their taxes to fund public funding of presidential campaigns. And so that ran all the way from Jimmy Carter through Reagan and Bush 1 Clinton until George Bush opted out of it because campaigns had gotten too expensive and the dues checkoff, the tax checkoff, wasn't large enough to cover the rising costs of campaigns. But states have now taken that up. Arizona, Connecticut, Maine, Minnesota have broad programs of public funding. A lot of states have public funding for judicial offices or maybe just for the top offices, governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general. But these four states, and Connecticut in particular, have very broad programs. It's amazing. I mean, people weren't sure whether or not the politicians would take public funding and give up funding their own campaigns. To qualify, they have to raise a nut. They have to show they have some public support. So if you're running for the state legislature in a House district, you got to collect small donations, under $100, from at least 300 of your constituents in order to qualify for a state subsidy. But after that, you agree to no more public funding, and nobody can donate more than $100 to any candidate in who takes part in this public funding campaign. So it's got a lid, and it's got a floor. And what it does is it creates much more competitive elections. People who never thought they could run for office can suddenly, you know, raise the money to qualify and then run for office. The people in the legislature have changed. There are three times as many people from minorities. There are twice as many women. And by the way, Republicans have done better. Republicans used to do a bad job raising money in Connecticut. Connecticut was dominated by Democrats, and the Republicans have now come up to almost even with the Democrats in the state legislature. So this is not something that favors Democrats as opposed to Republicans. What it tends to do is favor the underdog. The public funding system tends to favor the underdog wherever you are and to give ordinary people a chance. It's utterly amazing what they do. I mean, the best gun control law passed after the Sandy Hook massacre, and maybe it's not surprising because Sandy Hook was in Connecticut, was passed in Connecticut. And I asked Michael Brandy, the guy who runs the public funding program, why he thought that happened. He says, well, the gun lobbies, the NRA and the other lobbies, could go in and make their pitch to lawmakers. They could try to oppose the gun legislation, but they didn't donate to the campaigns. They couldn't dominate the legislature. They couldn't dictate to the legislature. And so the legislature went on, and they banned the AR-15, these semi-automatic rifles that are, I don't know why they're called rifles. They should be called machine guns with the way they fire. But, you know, they passed all kinds of regulations, background checks and so forth. As you said, they passed school lunch programs. They've passed health programs. The agenda is different. Just one example, there's a senator named Marilyn Moore. She comes from a poor district of Bridgeport. She's African-American. She grew up in poor. She was once on food stamps. She runs a nonprofit for African-American women with breast cancer. She has been elected to the state Senate for four terms with public funding. She is now chair of the Legislative Committee on Health and Social Services. Now just think about the impact on state policy and state laws in the arena of health and social policy if the chairman of the committee is someone with that kind of social background. Mm. I mean, that, you know, that's huge. That's the kind of, it's changed the political landscape of Connecticut domestically. It doesn't affect congressional elections. It doesn't affect the U.S. Senate. It doesn't affect Congress. It doesn't affect presidential elections. It's just for state elections. And it's impressive. It's impressive up in Maine. Similar kind of thing goes on up in Maine and so forth. It's probably the most effective method I've seen for counteracting big money in politics. With the federal laws the way they are, with the Supreme Court decisions the way they are, it's not possible in the foreseeable future to limit big money. And it's probably not possible outside of a few states like California to really expose big money. But public funding is something any state could adopt. And it has, particularly if you combine it with a lid. Now, this is a voluntary system. To qualify under Supreme Court decisions, it has to be voluntary. The candidates have to say, okay, I'll go this way. 80% of the candidates from both parties in Connecticut opt to take public funding rather than raise their own money. They say it's a more substantive campaign. They interact with the voters better. They don't have the nuisance of people who give them big money leaning on them when they get in office.
Well, Hedrick, unfortunately, we're out of time, but thank you for telling all of these incredible stories. Thanks for all of your great work over the years. We would love to have you back.
Well, thanks so much. Remind people it's on tonight in San Francisco.
All right. It's called The Democracy Rebellion. You can watch it on KQED if you're in the Bay Area tonight. You can also watch it online at PBS, or you can search on YouTube, The Democracy Rebellion. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.